Hello and welcome to the Oxford Society for International Development's podcast series. My name is Maddie Whitehead and I am a second year politics and philosophy student at the University of Oxford. I am also one of the South American events officers at OXID for this term and am delighted to be interviewing Dr. Elaine Carey today on the involvement of women in the drug trade. Elaine is currently the Dean of Arts and Sciences at Oakland University in Rochester, Michigan. Elaine has worked in higher education for many years after completing both a master's and a PhD in Latin American history. Her research focuses on drug trafficking, social movements, and human rights. Elaine has written many renowned and popular articles, as well as four books, including the award-winning Women Drug Traffickers, Mules, Bosses, and Organized Crime. The book focuses on a historical account of women involved in the drug economy in Mexico and how the experiences of female traffickers differs from their male counterparts. She is now currently working on a new book about overlapping transnational organized crime networks and drug distribution, titled Trains, Planes, Automobiles, and Narco Tanks: A Dope History. I am very excited to explore in this podcast today the role that women have played in the drug trade and hear about their stories, which are often overlooked by historians and the media alike. Hello, Elaine, and thank you for joining me. I am delighted to welcome you to our podcast today.
Hi, Maddie. I'm thrilled to be on the podcast today. Thank you so much for inviting me.
I would like to start with asking you a more general question about what made you want to research about accounts of women within organized crime, and why did you choose to center your study around women in Mexico?
To open, you know, really briefly, I mean, part of the focus began with Mexico because I am trained as a Mexican historian. But the story obviously is much broader because drug trafficking, transnational drug trafficking, is about the flows of drugs and how they move. So, you know, you're looking into all different aspects. So it really is a global history but Mexico remains the heart of it. And, you know, and I think in part, I wanted to really disrupt some of the perceptions about the role of women in organized crime. Even though I'm a big fan of Mario Puzo's The Godfather and Francis Ford Coppola's movies, that they kind of were set an idea that women were, they weren't involved at all in organized crime, that their role was essentially as, you know, their wives and girlfriends and sitting around stirring the sauce and, you know, providing, you know, drinks or something like that. And that was something that has really remained, this very gendered perception about the role of women in organized crime, and that they're way on the periphery, rather being central and really having a series of dynamic roles. So this began, and in part, this was also being familiar. You know, Mae Conklin, who was the wife of Al Capone, was a bootlegger. Well, that meant she was involved in organized crime. She was an organized crime leader. She ran her own organization that was involved in the illegal transportation of alcohol and distribution. Virginia Hill, who was, you know, widely been portrayed in films, you know, as the partner of Bugsy Siegel, but having almost, you know, having an important role, but she's always characterized as a courier. Well, she was a nexus between Italian and Jewish organized crime and Mexican drug producers. So she had a really prominent role. But again, she's been marginalized or almost forgotten. And I think for anyone who's interested in the study of organized crime, we could use another study of Virginia Hill and her centrality in transnational drug trafficking. So there were these other stories, and that's where I began to think and reconceptualize what is the role of women in organized crime, particularly in the distribution and trafficking of drugs and drug trafficking. Drug trafficking organizations are organized crime organizations. And so this began, you know, on one hand, having this kind of knowledge of that, you know, from a historical sense, also coming of age in Florida during the Florida drug wars in the 1980s. Obviously, I was exposed to, again, women involved in these organizations. It was in newspapers, and obviously some of that has come back, you know, particularly focusing around Griselda Blanco, who's one of the high-ranking women in the Medellin cartel. But also there were things in Mexico that were like these open secrets, right? They were there, they were in front of all of us, but no one was really kind of thinking about them and pulling them apart. So for instance, José Revueltas, a very famous Mexican novelist, writes about women in kind of the drug trade or criminal organizations. William Burroughs, the U.S. beat writer, you know, was really how I became introduced to Lola Chata, and became the basis of my research on women and drug trafficking. And it came through literature because I was reading beat writers, whether in Mexico or in the U.S., and really looking at how they were, you know, Jack Kerouac is another. Really looking at how they were talking about Mexico in the 50s and 60s. I was working on the student movement at that time. But that gave me, you know, I was trying to capture what was going on culturally, especially that might appeal to young people. And that started, you know, I started to see these tales or these stories that weren't stories, right? They were being fictionalized, but they were based on fact. And so that was really how, you know, kind of having these historical knowledge of women in organized crime in the U.S., seeing this in fictional accounts in Mexico, as well as kind of these lived experiences in the 1980s, where, you know, when during the Florida drug wars, which were all over Florida. And this, you know, I was living in a neighborhood where, you know, the DEA came in and raided, you know, a neighbor's house. And they not only raided the house, you know, they dug out the pool. They were looking for, you know, cocaine. You know, so these were things that, you know, so one, it's memory, but these other aspects is, like I said, there are these open secrets. And so it just meant asking a different question, you know, rather than saying the Godfather model is the most accurate one. It's like, well, here are these other things. So let me just ask a different question.
When we think about films like The Godfather, it's a very male-dominated arena. Do you think there's something particular about the trade of drug trafficking, which means that people are surprised to hear that women are taking an active role?
It's, you know, I began when I first started working on the book Women Drug Traffickers, there was a basic question that I kept asking myself. As I was researching, you know, different, really looking for women in archival material. And so part of this was, you know, if women control the informal economic sector in much of, in all the world, but, you know, some areas more than others, why wouldn't they be involved in drug trafficking? If they're selling illicit commodities in street markets, like alcohol, if they're selling food, if they're working in unregulated labor, if they're selling their bodies, why wouldn't they be selling drugs? In some ways, but all of these are dangerous. If you're involved in street marketing, it's dangerous for women. And if you're involved in prostitution, it's even more dangerous. And the subtle economic exchange that takes place with prostitution is very similar to that subtle economic exchange that takes place with drugs selling. So why wouldn't women be involved? That was my question that I kept going back to. And then the fact is that they were involved and in a highly sophisticated level. But again, that was, and I think this is something, you know, being trained in women and gender studies, you ask a different question of the same materials. It provides you clarity to see it in a different way, to see the archival materials in a different way, because you're asking a different question and you're pursuing that question. And so that leads you in a different trajectory than if you just say, well, men dominate organized crime, they dominate drug trafficking. If that is your focus, you're not going to see all the other aspects of it. If you're only looking at a handful of drug bosses too, you're not going to see how dynamic and how many different roles there are in transnational drug trafficking.
Now, if we could possibly focus a bit on the history of women in the drug trade, when did women first begin to be involved in drug trafficking? And what do you think the motivations are for women who are in the trade?
My work focuses on the more contemporary period. So obviously in the more contemporary, looking at, and especially looking hemispherically in the Americas, in which we start to see as after the Spanish-American War, the U.S. becomes very, very concerned about opium use in the Philippines. This leads the U.S., especially certain leaders within the U.S., religious leaders as well as politicians in the 1800s, to begin to demand greater control of the opium trade, and in some cases moving towards abolishment. At the same time, so this is happening obviously in the U.S., and then there are many kind of international meetings, and the League of Nations becomes involved, and there's a series of meetings. And then ultimately in the United States is the passage of the 1914 Harrison Act, which begins that aspect of control. There were states that were starting to control, opiate use or access to different types of opiates or opium derivatives. But by 1914, this will become, a policy, federal policy. And there was tremendous debate about this. I mean, finding, in the archives, for instance, that doctors, medical doctors in the United States were furious that politicians were engaged in this type of control that seemed to violate their work with patients. There were also patients who wrote to politicians arguing that, they relied on certain types of opiate derivatives to maintain their health. And so these things, it wasn't something that just everybody agreed upon. Well, then with the legislation, in part, it targeted certain people. It targeted men and women who were engaged in some medical professionals, nurses, doctors, and then also, there was in the United States, as Nancy Campbell and Carolyn Acker have written about, that women in the United States prior to the Harrison Act had the greatest drug use, use of opium. And this was because it was widely prescribed for, hysteria, menstrual cramps, whatever. It was prescribed. And so this led to, a class of addicts. And then again, politicians, predominantly men, were concerned about the use of drugs by white middle-class and upper-middle-class women. And so these things begin to really factor into the role of women. So you have one hand, you have women, certain group of women who are addicts, who were maintained by medical professionals. And then all of a sudden that's not available. Women have long been involved, as I talked about, in street marketing and being involved in the drug trade. And globally, so it could be through, vending, whether it was legal or illegal, but as it becomes illegal, and as there's greater pressure, And because it is illegal, then obviously the demand for people who are trying to avoid dope sickness, that increases. And of course, it's increasing the cost, and it drives more people into the trade because they're providing that. And so what I started to see early in my research is right away, when the Harrison Act is passed, there are organizations where women were equal partners involved in the drug trade. Now, and so that's in 1914, 1915, 1916, on into the 1920s. So you have women who are operating in the United States and in Mexico, or along the U.S.-Mexico border. And Mexico is in the midst of the Mexican Revolution at this time. And so, you know, there is, you know, drug trans, you know, border drug trade, but not at the level as it would become once the fighting really subsides. And so, but the aspect that is that women are involved from the beginning in million-dollar organizations. So the Harrison Act is passed in 1914, and all of a sudden we're seeing in, you know, in the teens, in the 19-teens, that women are equal partners in transnational drug organizations, and that are yielding $1 million a year in 1916. It's a whole lot of money. So these are, and then there are others where, and this is harder to find, like women's roles in, say, the 19-teens and 20s, where they're not bosses, but they're maybe working on consignment. Or they operate as almost like a franchise within a organized crime network. So, and again, they might be running their own crews. So a woman might be providing distribution for a larger organization, but she is an integral part of that larger organization. And that is harder to find, but there is evidence of this. And again, that really means kind of digging through the archives and looking for that. And that takes a tremendous amount of time and a lot of effort, but it's worth it because these are really fascinating stories of, but again, hard to find because drug traffickers don't leave their papers to archives outlining the complexity of their organization.
That was really interesting to hear. Thank you. And I think when the drug traffickers aren't difficult to find, they tend to be quite renowned and people have lots of perceptions about them. And I was wondering how you see women in the drug economy being depicted compared to their male counterparts, whether this is through the media or by drug fighting organizations. How did their perceptions of women and men differ?
The depiction of women, you know, changes over time. You know, so, I mean, it changes in the aspect of how public it is and where it's public. So, you know, currently, even though there's, you know, great, you know, the internet and stuff, we see the same women repeating. But, you know, it seems, I would say probably every year or two, there's another, oh my God, this part of the Sinaloa cartel or the Gulf cartel is controlled by a woman. And which is, you know, we're now in a century of women who are leading or equal partners in drug trafficking organizations. But we're still, this makes great news. And in part, it's this gendered aspect of not, of saying like, well, you know, drug trafficking organizations are, you know, hyper-masculine. And I don't deny that in aspects, yes, they are. But they're more than just one or two people. And once you consider the sophistication of the organization, and the fact that the majority of people are not going to be at the top, whether male or female, leaders are rise to the top for a number of reasons. They're charismatic. They're extremely intelligent. Doesn't mean necessarily that they're highly educated, but they're extremely intelligent. They understand illicit business at a highly sophisticated level. They understand business and they have tremendous social networks that facilitate their ability. And they build those over time. Occasionally someone will inherit that, but they do build them over time. And so, you know, this is this kind of scintillating approach to the fact of women is also tied to, you know, especially now with social media and kind of the narco life that's featured in, you know, con las buchonas and things that you see, you know, whether on Instagram or in kind of, you know, B movies or B TV shows or things like that. And so this is, you know, in part, there's kind of this greater attention that has come through, you know, literature like The Queen of the South, for instance, and the films. But also it's like there's a certain way women aren't supposed to cross a certain line. And then once they do, where they're leaders of a particular part of the organization, then all of a sudden this is something that is newsworthy. Now, we know, too, that a drug trafficking organization is going to be far more successful if it's able to operate under the radar. So just as we see, you know, the association of organizations with male leaders, it doesn't mean, we know, too, that once the male leader is extradited to the United States and stands trial and is incarcerated, the organization continues. So who's involved in the continuing of the organization? And frequently it can be a couple of people or it can be many people. And those are men and women. So, you know, again, this is something I think, you know, when the policing of the Ariano Felix organization began, and, you know, there was all this stuff about, we don't understand, you know, we have extradited, you know, we have tried and convicted. Sometimes they have, you know, have been killed. And the organization continues to operate. Well, what we later found out, it was because, well, one of the sisters, Ana Nadina, who was educated, was always involved, was always an equal partner, and really kind of managed the business side. So one of the things that is coming out in, you know, that we don't get from some of the sensationalism is that frequently women in the trade, especially if they've been brought in by their family members, such as by their fathers, because maybe their fathers were in the trade and they recruit them in, and they recruit them because they are the most capable of their children. And frequently they will be more educated than men in the organization. So, and that means that frequently women are involved in larger on business side. So again, you're looking at the complexity of, you know, who's involved in, you know, obviously the production, the distribution, the trafficking, you know, the business side, the laundering, all those things. It's very complicated and there are different people involved. But one of the things we're seeing is that women in the organizations are fairly well educated and are frequently on business sides or laundering sides or things like that. And that's a very different depiction than frequently what we get in popular culture. So, you know, again, there's this gender fix, you know, kind of this fixation on, you know, the girlfriends or the beauty queens or the beauty pageants and the women who are associated with men or who are kind of living the narco life in social media and kind of featured as mob bosses and stuff. And then there's women who are actually involved in the daily operations of a highly sophisticated organization. And sometimes they're the same, but often they're not. And again, those women who are kind of, and men, who are working and keeping an organization going may not be known, and that is how the organization continues, is the fact that they're able to operate still and not be identified.
You spoke a bit about women on average being more educated than the men brought into the drug trade, which I thought was really interesting. And is there anything else specific about being a female in drug trafficking that can give a woman an advantage over a man, whether this is to do with a certain characteristic that they tend to bring to the table or to do with the conceptions that perhaps other men around them may have of them, which means that they can sometimes surprise them or bring something different?
The difference is, you know, kind of the gender assumptions that we'll see about the organizations where they're like, oh my God, there's a woman who's leading this particular part of the organization. Has benefited women because frequently in policing, they didn't identify that women would be involved in the drug trade. So even when they begin, you know, along the U.S.-Mexico border, it is because women were involved in smuggling, and they had to hire female agents to search women smugglers because men could not search them. And so in some ways, the role of women in criminal organizations actually provided positions for women in policing organizations, you know, especially in you know, what is now Border Patrol, and through the Department of Homeland Security. And so this evolves. I mean, there were women involved in you know, working in different areas, but not at necessarily at that high level policing. And so women involved in drug and smuggling kind of helped to build that. So, you know, so a lot of women will, because of the aspect of policing, is they were able to operate and not be identified. And at the same time, too, if they were arrested, they could use gendered arguments. You know, so there was an assumption that if a woman was involved in a drug organization, that she must have been forced by men in her family or her husband, you know, whoever. And so women would frequently say that. That was a way of which to ensure that they might get a lighter sentence or, in fact, not even be convicted. And so they would use these gendered arguments. Well, I was forced into it. He made me do it. And this would allow them to actually, you know, not be convicted, and then they could return to the business. It is rare, but we do see women who will actually say, this is all of mine, this is my business, I run it. And many times that's to deflect, right? It's to say they're going to take responsibility. They've already been brought into custody, they've been arrested, they're going to take responsibility. And that allows other people in the organization to continue to work. So for instance, Maria Dolores Estevez Zuleta, Lola Chata, was one who publicly did this. And that allowed other people who were in her organization not to be arrested, because she said it was all of my responsibility, all my doing. And you see this repeating. This by taking all of the responsibility and all the blame, this ensures that other people in the organization, whether male or female, are able to continue to work within the organization, because that ultimately is the role, is to keep the flows of drugs and the flow of money. So, you know, so women have been able to kind of manipulate those and use those. Some of the other things that are kind of interesting is, and especially in the historical aspect, where women would be arrested who were involved in the drug trade and who were not repentant. And who would claim, you know, yeah, I'm going to get out in two, you know, because the sentences were lighter. You know, I'm going to get out in 3 years, and I'll be right back doing it. And the fact that people were surprised by that. And so there is even a gender aspect where, you know, that women were supposed to be more apologetic, more repentant, more willing to, you know, to turn to a new life, and that wasn't necessarily the case. So there was a lot of surprise in that too. Where again, if we're thinking of women who, what was their other, you know, especially if you're looking for an uneducated working class woman, what were the other opportunities for her? Working as a domestic, working as a prostitute, or maybe selling drugs. And so, you know, again, women, just like men, were making strategic economic decisions. And so this was fueling their response to, you know, to policing agents who were surprised by that. And so this would also, the role of women in crime, whether in Mexico or in the United States, because of the role of women, this will change, that they will need more women police to go undercover, really, because women will trust women more and might disclose more things. So we see a lot of these changes happening in part because of the role that women are in. But women are able to navigate this and use gendered concepts to their benefit when needed, but then they also can rebel against them too when it suits them and when it can be helpful for their organization.
It is clear that every move that women make as leaders in the drug trafficking industry is strategic. And I was wondering if we could talk about how the sexuality of these women has been used throughout the history of drug trafficking, whether it's as a strategy and to their advantage. And if these women are using it as part of a strategic means, would you say that they're in control of how they're using their sexuality, or is it still rooted in some kind of exploitation?
In the contemporary period, we see women using their sexuality as a means of you know, drawing attention. You know, I think of, you know, Claudia Achoa Felix, who was known as the Empress of Anthrax, but also known as the Kim Kardashian of organized crime. She had a very vibrant social media presence and kind of leading the narco life. And this, she's not the only one, obviously. And so there is a, you know, it is sexually titillating. It's part, but it's also demonstrating aspects of that she was showing of power and influence. And then, of course, when she's identified as being a leader, she will actually hold a press conference and, you know, with her children and her parents surrounding her, and actually say that this is not, that this is all kind of, you know, something that's created. It's for entertainment. It isn't the truth, that she isn't the Empress of Anthrax. So we can see aspects of kind of using, you know, so here in that case, juxtaposing kind of her social media presence of kind of the narco life, then juxtaposing the image of, you know, that I'm a mother and I'm, you know, supporting my children and you know, as a single mother, you know, so I have to, you know, find a way to survive. And these are some of the things that I've decided to do. So again, she's making a strategic decision to use her sexuality because she understands there's a market for that, just as she understood there's a market for drugs. But then at the same time, she wants to use that more as entertainment and maintain, you know, distance. And again, the most successful drug trafficker is the one who has able, or in organized crime, the one to create the most distance between the actual crime itself and themselves. And so that in many ways was also a strategic move of understanding how these organizations work, and in case how entertainment industry works too in social media, and then balancing that. So we see a lot of play with that. You know, there's other, you know, women too, where you know, one of the Sandra Avila Beltran, you know, was, you know, recognized as, you know, the queen of the Pacific and her family ties, and again seen as very beautiful, and she too has been able to kind of recast that in a way of being one, an expert on drug trafficking. You know, she did go to prison, but she gave interviews. But she, when she was initially quote unquote captured, you know, she kind of controlled the whole process of that in a very interesting way, how she was photographed and how she was going to be portrayed in the media. She projected a different type of image that we would have seen in other kind of mugshots that would have been of women and who had been arrested, say, in the 40s and 50s, and who were less likely to kind of play and manipulate aspects of the media. And again, I think this is about education. It's about understanding. It's also about their own analysis. And so I think it's a tremendous amount of strategic and sophisticated thinking. So, you know, the women, their sexuality has routinely been targeted. So Griselda Blanco is a great one, you know, where that she is kind of this, you know, coked out nymphomaniac, you know, all of these different things about her. And really, a lot of these conversations, and these will be men in her crew too, who were arrested, it undermines her ability to run the organization. And And it's something that, having been asked to do different types of shows and things like that, that's frequently what they're interested in about women. And is about their sexuality, and they want they want that type of analysis, but that's not the reality. I mean, they're business women first, and I'm always amazed how we don't talk about the sexuality of the men. So for women, it's a sign of weakness. Their sexuality is a sign of weakness, whether they're mothers, whether they're lesbians. Their relationships with men, that it's some aspect of a weakness. While for a man, his sexual prowess is something to be celebrated. It demonstrates his power and his influence. But on the other hand, for a woman who's a leader, it is a sign of her weakness and her vulnerability. And so that's something that is that we see repeating in the media. So it's sometimes created that women are doing that, but then also it's continually represented, that somehow a woman like Griselda Blanco or Mary Valencia, who was in the, Cali cartel, that their sexuality is somehow a weakness, within the organization. But for men, it's something to be celebrated. So I would love to see more scholars really kind of unpacking male sexuality within the drug trade. If you scratch beneath the surface and you start asking some different questions, you'll start to see some different things. And I think it's an area that's ripe for greater analysis.
It has been really interesting hearing about the lives and perceptions of these women. And you've talked a bit about how it is difficult to access these stories because generally people in the drug trade do not like to leave a trace. So I was wondering if you could talk a bit to our listeners about your research process and where you were getting your sources from and how you were combating the challenge of having difficulty with finding out all of this information.
So I think, anytime you're starting, a new project, and I kind of talked about, that basic question, if women dominate the informal economic sector, why wouldn't they be in drug trafficking? And then kind of going from there. And I've really benefited from the work of other scholars. So Luisa Storga, Benjamin Smith, Paul Gutenberg, Isaac Campos, Nancy Campbell, who I mentioned previously, David Courtwright. It was really starting to see some of their work, and I think this is important, you start to see as you're working and someone's working parallel and you start to have those conversations, you start to see different ways and then where your work might fit a little bit differently. So my work actually started from, I sat in the New York Public Library in 42nd Street, the research library, and literally went through doing bullying searches, newspapers, historical newspapers. And at that time, not as many had been digitized. This was the New York Times, the LA Times, and a couple of others. And those were really great newspapers to start with, right? Because these are where big ports coming in. I would add that, for some of the other areas. But so these are two cities where there's a lot of drug flows, international drug flows that come in. And then, as other things, there were collections of digitized papers on the U.S.-Mexico border. And so those were really helpful, too. And so what I started to look for is, obviously, if you, do, word searches and stuff like that, you get tons of things. So I had to decide, well, what am I looking for? And I'm looking for women in large organizations. I was looking for bosses and equal partners. And so that's what I did for one entire summer. When I received cases that I saw repeating, so I was looking for patterns, right, that there would be cases that were repeating, that there would be people, organizations, then I would try and find greater materials on them. And of course, frequently, not all of these were cataloged. So it was going to the Franklin Delano Roosevelt Archive, which is the first presidential archive in the United States. And because of his long career, not only are his papers there, but there are also lots of other papers. The New York Academy of Medicine. In Mexico, the National Archive in Mexico, the Archive for the Secretary of Health, the Archive for the Secretary of Foreign Relations. And I was literally piecing together these stories. It came from going through newspapers and then looking for these particular cases and then going into different archives. I also worked in many of the regional national archives in the United States. So the main one, National Archives in DC and in College Park, that's where the DEA papers are located, but also in California and in Texas and in, the Midwest. And so, you know, because again, people aren't in one particular place, you know, they're moving. And that's the other thing. These are global histories. And it was piecing them together and in different places. And sometimes I would have, an organization that I thought was really successful, and I just couldn't find enough material to really kind of write a very complete history of them. It would have been, so some of them in the book are incomplete. Not that they aren't important, it's just I didn't find the archival evidence that would support a bigger study of them. And so, you know, I think to scholars who are starting to get to really look at the history of drugs and, it's a way, I think there's some, and along the way, I also uncovered other things. So for instance, there's, you know, in the Rockefeller archives, they have, during the Bureau of, one of their bureaus, they did interviews with drug users and drug traffickers in the 1920s. It's a great resource. There were studies of that social workers did in New York City of bars. Now, they were looking to see that bars were actually operating as bars. It was for tax reasons. It was for these questions about kind of short stay hotels that bars were operating. So it was dealing with prostitution. But in doing those studies, they uncovered these unbelievable networks of drug trafficking. Few scholars have used those works to really look at the drug trade. And so I think there are lots of opportunities for anyone who's interested. Again, it's having the time and the interest to kind of do that serious archival work. I love it. I think that is the nature of what it means to be a historian. And I think there's a lot of opportunities there. But it was, so I started, I'll be frank, Women Drug Traffickers began in 1997. The book did not come out until 2014. Took me a long time.
The final question I'd like to ask you today is if there's been a particular story of a female involved in the drug trade that really stood out to you throughout your research. And if there was, I was hoping you could share with us a bit about who this female was, what she did, where she was based, and any other interesting information about her.
I'll start with the first person I worked on, and that's Maria Dolores Estevez Zuleta, Lola Chata, was the first article. I was working on my dissertation, so again, this is 1997, I was in the National Library in Mexico City, which is, in close to the National Autonomous University, and I had mentioned before I had read Burroughs, and Burroughs had used Lola Lachata Estevez as a repeating character, and she would repeat sometimes under the name Lola, sometimes under the name Lupe, Lupita, and he uses these characters over and over again in his writing. And so it was a day, normally I would take a break, I'd go walk around. That particular day it was raining. And so I went and looked for Mexican cultural criticism of Burroughs. And I came across a book and I was like, oh my gosh, she's real. And because I was in the library held the National Newspaper Archive. And so I went and read the newspaper coverage of her. And again, it was the same, but these were in huge books and, you know, it wasn't through a computer. It was the actual pages and some of them were ripped and, you know, and so I'm turning these pages going through decade after decade in different newspapers. But I read the newspaper coverage of her and I thought, wow. And so over the next couple of years, I would continue to work on her and looking for material about her. And that's where, you know, all of a sudden, you know, this, and I thought it's just going to be an article about her. But as I got into, you know, different paper, different archives, different libraries, all of a sudden I started to see other women. And so the project that I initially thought I would do as my second project after working on student movements, I never did. And I totally switched. And so, you know, Lola Chato is really, was, as I mentioned, kind of hiding in plain sight. You know, she was there in Burroughs's literature, but she had also been exposed by H.J. Anslinger, the leader of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, which is a predecessor to the Drug Enforcement Administration. She was, they were attempting to extradite her. Her organization, while she was based in Mexico City, she had also lived along the U.S.-Mexico border. So she had learned about trans-border trafficking. She also shows signs of kind of how women in the trade work. She, her mother began to traffic in morphine and marijuana. Again, far more lucrative than what she was selling previously, which were food products. So then there's that connection, right? Family involvement. Lola Chata's daughters would become involved in the drug trade. So again, then we start to see three generations. She was married to a former police officer who was a recognized drug trafficker, Enrique Jaramillo. So again, what we start to see is this combination of support between policing, you know, aspects of kind of corruption policing and the drug trade. She had, not only was she based in Mexico City, she had a legitimate side of her business as well as an illicit side of her business. But she also had processing labs that were close to the U.S.-Mexico border, which meant she was using this road system that was a predecessor to the Pan American Highway. She was in business with other policing agents. She was a boss at every aspect we could imagine. And even though she was in and out of prison, she continued to traffic and sell drugs until her death in the late 1950s. So when I look at her longevity in the drug trade, she had far more longevity than many of contemporary male traffickers. And I think so that was how it started. I mean, I think I see, you know, more work on her, really in Mexico, people recognizing that she is one of the early, most successful drug traffickers. There's been less work on her husband, was also identified in the U.S. as a highly skilled, so they were recognized as an equal partnership. And so what I saw is other equal partnerships, you know, not only in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, but coming up into the 60s and the 70s of husband and wives teams working together or these family networks. And so really she became understanding her organization and her work really kind of set the tone for the rest of my research and really understanding how the drug trade works in a historical context, which then helped to understand how the current drug trade works. So she is the one that really started the entire project. And I never went back to doing any work on the Mexican communist youth.
It's fascinating to hear about specific stories such as Lola's. Thank you. And thank you very much for joining me today. It's been really wonderful being able to tap into your expertise about women and the drug trade. And I've really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you so much, Maddie. Thank you so much for inviting me. And I've really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you again.
To all of our listeners, this has been Maddie Whitehead, the South American Events Officer at the Oxford Society for International Development. I hope that you've enjoyed this podcast today, and please feel free to keep up to date on all of our social medias for more interesting discussions in the future.